There's been exhaustive research and thousands of books devoted to the Third Reich, so it might seem as though there's nothing new to be discovered about the Nazi regime. Norman Ohler proves otherwise in his new book, Blitzed, Drugs in the Third Reich, in which he reveals the extent to which the Hitler, members of his party, the military, and German civilians were addicted to hard drugs. It's already an international bestseller, and it's being published in the United States by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. I'm very pleased that it has brought novelist, screenwriter, and journalist Norman Ohler to our show today. Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me.
Didn't you grow up in Western Germany before the fall of the wall?
Yes, I grew up in a small town called Zweibrücken, which I label as the Twin Peaks of Germany, and it's right on the edge of Germany. It's actually on the border of France.
But did growing up in West Germany play a role in how you came to research this aspect of the Third Reich? Would it have been different if you'd grown up in East Germany? Would your whole sense of what happened have been different?
I'm sure. I don't know how different, but I'm sure it would have been different. I mean, part of my of me becoming a writer was talking to my grandfather about Nazi Germany, and he certainly would not have lived in East Germany because he hated the communists. So growing up in West Germany and talking with my grandfather, that certainly had a big influence on me and becoming a writer and then in the end writing Blitzed.
He expressed a certain nostalgia for the regime.
Well, this was in
was
the
80s. Common?
Yeah, well, in the 80s it was more common. Today, most people who experienced that time are dead. But in the 80s, there still was a bit of nostalgia, I suppose. There was like this sense of under Hitler, everything was in order in Germany. Or if something went wrong in Western society in the 80s, some older people would say, under Hitler, this wouldn't have happened. And obviously this was of interest to me and worthy for discussion.
Many Germans also said that they weren't aware of the concentration camps, but didn't he witness a train full of Jewish prisoners on its way to the concentration camps?
Yeah, he was a railway engineer, and when he saw that train, he realized that something was off, because he told me this was against the regulations for train, what should happen in trains, because there were humans in a cattle train. So that's when he realized that something was really off the rail.
And then that was your maternal grandfather. Your paternal grandfather fought in the Wehrmacht in the Soviet Union.
Yeah, he was wounded in the Soviet Union, and then he was put together again in a hospital in Munich and sent to the Western Front, where then the Americans captured him and actually. He was transported all the way to Huntsville, Texas, where he was a prisoner of war.
You've said that your anger towards the German Reich compelled you to become a writer and a journalist. In what way? I mean, since you have people who were in the Reich during their lifetimes, didn't you feel some kind of family connection to them?
No, I felt actually quite appalled to how my grandfather reacted to those times. And I was appalled to everyone who was into repressing knowledge and information about the Third Reich. And so I decided I want to be on the other side. I want to be a writer. I want to help the democratic process through my writing. That was kind of my teenage idea.
What led you to inquire into the use of drugs during World War II? Was this common knowledge?
No, this is, I guess, the scoop of Blitzed, that it certainly was not common knowledge, but has now been exposed. I mean, there was a little bit about it. Some military historians have written shorter articles about it, but then actually the turning point for me to really start the research was a conversation I had with a friend, a very quirky friend who was a DJ in a Berlin underground club. And he told me one morning, after spinning records the whole night in the so-called Club of Visionaries in Berlin, which is in my neighborhood in Kreuzberg, that the Nazis used all these drugs and I should examine this and write about this in my next book.
And you were thinking of doing a novel on the topic.
Yeah, it sounded like a great topic for a novel, so I started developing characters. But also I started doing proper research, and I started to go into several archives and have a look at if there were any documents. I had no idea if it is documented.
And where did you find the documents? It was just in Germany, or did you? It says in the press release that you also found information in the United States. What would you have found here?
Well, one of the main sources are the notes of a doctor called Theo Morell, who became Hitler's personal physician. And his notes are being kept in two separate locations in Germany. And then while I was comparing the notes in those, one is in Munich and one is in Koblenz Federal Archive in Germany, one is the Institute for Contemporary History in Germany, I found a note that originally all these records were in one place, which was Washington, D.C., National Archives of the United States. So I wrote to them and asked them, did you give everything back to Germany? Why did you split it up to two locations? What's the story? And they replied, well, it was a little bit of chaos, a post-war chaos of not knowing what to give back at what time, or making a decision to give back part of it to this institute and part of it to that. And possibly there's more to be found in D.C. and I should come and have a look. So I boarded a plane and had a look, and actually found things that hadn't been released, hadn't been given back to Germany.
In his notes, he kept a journal of his patients and prescriptions. And you decided that the person he named patient A was Hitler. Well, do we know for sure?
Yeah, we know for sure. I mean, he explains that that patient A is Hitler. So sometimes he calls him also F, which stands for Führer, mm-hmm. which means leader. Morell's notes are not basic, but straightforward. Mm-hmm. He doesn't. It's a very vivid, very detailed descriptions of what was going on between him and patient A.
Didn't he start out by giving Hitler vitamin injections? When did it move on to heavy drugs?
Well, Morell was a kind of celebrity doctor of Berlin before he met Hitler. He was treating actresses and sports stars and blue bloods, and he was famous for giving vitamin injections, but also probiotics. He was a pioneer. He had ideas that most doctors at the time didn't have. And also when he met Hitler in 1936, Hitler complained about his stomach cramps, and he said all of my doctors could not save me from this pain, and it blocks me from becoming the efficient leader I really want to become. I really want to be. So many things to do every day, and I spend a couple of hours in pain. And can you help me, Morell? And Morell gave him a probiotic medicine that actually cured Hitler, and that installed faith in Hitler that this Morell guy is actually. He immediately appointed him as personal physician, and they spent more time together than he spent more time with Morell than with anyone else. And in the beginning, yes, it's vitamins and probiotics and glucose and rather harmless things, maybe even healthy things. I mean, Hitler was portrayed as a health nut and
a vegetarian.
Yeah, teetotaler, no alcohol, no coffee. But then in 1941, for the first time in his notes, in Morell's notes, I read about an opioid that was given, Optalidone, if I remember correctly. Another opioid he gave was Dolantin. And he also started, because Hitler was sick in 1941 in the fall, during the campaign against the Soviet Union, he had high fever and diarrhea, and he couldn't go to the military briefing, so he said to Morell, give me something that will enable me to get up within the next couple of hours, which is difficult if you really have a severe illness, but Morell's injection was able to do that. From that moment on, Hitler requires more and more of these hormones, and especially opioids.
Wasn't Germany already a major manufacturer and exporter of pharmaceuticals before the war, during the Weimar Republic?
Well, in Germany in 1805, while Goethe was writing his Faust, a young chemist called Saturna isolated morphine. Mm-hmm. And that, in a way, is the beginning of the modern pharmaceutical industry as we know it today.
But also aspirin. Didn't that come from Bayer, the German company?
Well, aspirin is still a product by Bayer, and the same guy who developed aspirin developed also heroin for Bayer, which was also a patent for Bayer. So he actually developed these two drugs within 10 days. So most of the drugs we know today at one point were legal German products.
But then weren't there strict laws against the consumption of narcotics after the Nazis took over?
It's kind of the irony of the story, or the hypocrisy of the Nazi regime's ideology presenting itself as a regime that would clean the German society of all the toxins. In a way, they invented the war on drugs.
But it's tied to anti-Semitism, you say.
Well, they used anti-drugs policies when they took power in 1933 to go against minorities. The Jews were labeled as a toxin, were poison, were called a poison. The drugs were a poison. Anti-drugs and anti-Semitic policy went hand in hand in the beginning. You can actually see this in the war on drugs, that it has been used over the decades in order to press down on unwanted minorities.
In fact, we talked earlier about the war on drugs in this country being used against people of color.
Exactly.
So when, in this case, it was the Jews who...
Yeah.
Was there high consumption of illicit drugs by Jews at that time?
That's what the Nazis claimed. The Nazis really hated the Weimar Republic. And the Weimar Republic, they called the Jewish Republic. And it was the republic where everyone was taking drugs. And I read propaganda writings by Nazis saying that most of the doctors in Berlin are Jewish. They all take morphine. The Jew is a nervous character that needs morphine. So they try to, and cocaine, Jews take cocaine all the time. They try to connect heavy drug use with the Jewish character, which is obviously a total propaganda and racist propaganda.
So how did the production and consumption of narcotics at such high volume begin in Germany in this atmosphere? There's a company called Temmler. How important are they to this story?
They're very important. They're still a global player today. They developed a drug called Pervitin after the Olympic Games in Berlin, when rumor had it that the American athletes had been using benzedrine, which is amphetamine, to enhance their performance. So the head of Temmler said, we're going to make a better amphetamine. Amphetamine was legal at the time. It wasn't considered a drug like morphine or heroin or cocaine. So his main chemist developed methamphetamine, which they then branded as Pervitin. Today we know methamphetamine as crystal meth, obviously. So this came onto the market, this flooded the market as a totally legal medication. You didn't even need a prescription for it.
Sold over the counter.
Yeah.
It was even sold in the form of chocolate.
Well, there's a photo of an ad in Blitz showing a very happy German Fräulein or housewife eating a Pervitin, a methamphetamine-laced chocolate. It had 13 milligrams of pure methamphetamine, and the slogan went, Hildebrand, that was the brand name, Hildebrand chocolate's always a delight. And it shows you how that it wasn't stigmatized to use methamphetamine. It was part of the game, part of the rat race. You used it to be at your best.
You describe Pervitin as national socialism in pill form. What do you mean by that?
Well, we have to understand that the dictatorship of National Socialism was a very modern society, a very modern performance-driven society. Hitler did was give everyone a job. So people were very active at the time. The Nazi slogan was Germany, wake up. And Pervitin, a methamphetamine, kind of keeping you up. You can't sleep when you're in crystal meth. It fit the times perfectly. It kind of just made you... Meth is not a drug that makes you question something. Meth is a drug that makes you believe in something. Believe in something good's going to happen. Everything's going to... You're going to be active. You're going to be part of something. That's also the fake hope that meth users have today in parts of the United States. You use meth, then you fix your car, and then you take another phone call, and you kind of try to trick yourself into believing that you're actually doing something worthwhile, while actually you're chasing something that will never come true and that will ultimately destroy you.
Norman Ohler's book Blitzed: Drugs in the Third Reich is an international bestseller, and it's being published in this country by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. We will continue our conversation after this. And we are back with Norman Ohler, O-H-L-E-R. His latest book is Blitzed: Drugs in the Third Reich. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. You mentioned that Hitler had a change in health in 1941, and that led to his more serious drug use. Do we know what happened, why he was running those fevers?
I mean, he was in his headquarters in the so-called Wolf's Lair, and the war against the Soviet Union was getting into a decisive phase. This was in August 41. Germans had made huge advances, actually, but the decisive question was whether they would go for Moscow or whether they would split up the troops, and part of the army would go north towards Leningrad and part would go south towards the Ukraine. This was Hitler's great plan. The high command said, no, we should take Moscow. So there was a big dispute. And he reacted to criticism in an immediate physical way. And this time he gets, in German we say the Ruhr. I don't know the English translation. It's also called the Russian fever. I mean, he had high fever. He was lying in bed. He couldn't go to the military briefing. This was a sensation in headquarters. The Führer's not there.
So morale prescribed a drug cocktail.
Well, Morel would always give a drug cocktail. He was a master with the syringe, so he would put different things into the injection every day that he gave Hitler. But before that, it was usually vitamins. Like he would say, today we give a vitamin C combined with vitamin B, or I mean, kind of similar what many of us take today when we take vitamin supplements. But that day, he puts in an opioid for the first time into his cocktail, and that's certainly that's a game changer.
And it's what we would call OxyContin.
That's the active ingredient. So I guess that might be the American brand name. That the German brand names are different, but it's high. It's very similar. It's also similar to heroin, actually. Just what he gave Hitler was a special. Especially later was called Oikodal, which William Burroughs called some truly awful stuff. I guess he meant that as a compliment. It was William Burroughs' favorite drug, I assume. It has the effect of also making you euphoric. So it is an opiate that makes you euphoric. That's what Hitler really liked, that effect.
Because even during the darkest days, he could feel good about himself and good about the situation. You write about his meeting with Mussolini, which followed an assassination attempt. A second doctor treated Hitler after the assassination attempt, and what did he give him?
Well, this assassination attempt is known as Operation Valkyrie, and it's the bomb that Stauffenberg detonated in the military briefing room, which severely injured Hitler, actually.
His arm?
Well, his eardrums were blown, perforated. He had hundreds of splinters in his body. And he had a meeting with Mussolini a few hours later, so obviously everyone wanted to cancel the meeting, but he said, I'm not going to take the meeting, because he had immediately after the explosion, he had received a very powerful shot by Morel, which cured him of all his pain and made him completely euphoric again. He said, I lived through this. This is a miracle. Of course I'm going to meet with Mussolini. All the other people that had been touched by this bomb were in the hospital. Some were dead. Some had very, very severe injuries. And then a new doctor comes in. Giesing is his name. He was later interrogated by U.S. intelligence. And he gave a very detailed report of how he gives cocaine to Hitler for the first time against the pain also. And how he realizes that Hitler absolutely loves this application. And there are a few quite funny quotes actually in the book of Hitler talking about cocaine and saying to Giesing, don't examine me, give me the cocaine and everything will be fine. Or quick, give me the cocaine. I have an important meeting with my generals. I want to be clear in my head. And he takes cocaine over 50 times within just, I think, 2 months it is from late July to late September 1944.
But then he's taking a combination of cocaine and Yucadol.
Well, he has two doctors.
You called it a classic speedball, but doesn't cocaine work in the opposite, to have an opposite effect from an opioid?
Well, that is the speedball. You have kind of two colliding forces that somehow complement each other and create a very strong effect, which kind of sets your whole system into a state of alert and, I guess, inebriation. He had these two doctors, Giesing giving him cocaine, Morel giving him the opioid, and these two doctors hated each other, so they would not talk. I mean, it wasn't like an open... They didn't have like a meeting and discussed how to effectively treat Hitler. It was just a completely different setup.
Can we say that Hitler was a drug addict? Was he aware that he might be addicted?
Well, from after Operation Valkyrie till the end of 1944, he was certainly a drug addict because he receives very high dosages of Oxycontin, this Oikodal brand, 20 milligrams shot intravenously, injected into his veins every other day. This drug creates a physical dependency after 2 weeks, and he used it for a much longer time. So certainly he was a drug addict in that phase of the war.
And then we have the use of drugs in the German military. Otto Rank administered drugs to soldiers.
Well, this Otto Rank, he was a professor in Berlin responsible before the war for performance enhancement of the army. So he would kind of decide, should they use brown bread? What toast should they eat in the morning? And then he realized there's something out there called pervitin, which is the methamphetamine. It's very popular in the civil society. Factory workers would take it, and everyone would take it. He studied what universities had found out about methamphetamine at the time, and this was, number one, it reduces your fear, number two, it reduces your need to sleep, and he thought this could be great for the German army. And he was able to create a methamphetamine program which was officially integrated into the German strategy. There was a so-called stimulant decree issued before the attack on France in May 1940. 35 million dosages of methamphetamine were being distributed, were being shipped from the Temla factory to the front lines.
And it influenced, you say, Germany's strategy for the invasion of France. How did the drugs influence the route through the Ardennes Mountains?
Well, that was a high risk strategy to go through the Ardennes Mountains. The Allies never thought the Germans would dare to do that because Churchill said they will have to rest at night. It's very hard. The terrain's very hard to go through. We can destroy them while they are stuck in those mountain villages. But the German idea was to charge through those mountains within 3 days and three nights without sleeping and reach the French border town of Sedan, while the British and French armies were still in the north of Belgium. And this is exactly what they did, using these millions of dosages of pervitin so they wouldn't have to sleep. There's a famous quote in Blitz by the tank general Guderian saying to his men, he was kind of the inventor of the Blitzkrieg, saying to his men after the defeat of France, I asked you to stay awake for 3 days and three nights, and you did it for 17 days and 17 nights, which is, you know,
so just given the pills?
Well, these pills are very strong. The French army, for example, was also given a drug, which was red wine. 3,500 trucks filled with red wine made their way from the French wine regions to the troops. And if you compare red wine with methamphetamine, you can see that it would have a very different effect.
Mm-hmm. The German Navy supplied Marines with cocaine chewing gum toward the end of the war. What kinds of missions were that used on?
I mean, pervitin, methamphetamine, was so popular throughout the war that towards the end, when the Navy developed new mini-submarines, because all their big submarines by that time, the big U-boats had been sunk, these mini-submarines were supposed to make their way all the way up to the Thames River and torpedo American ships and British ships. And for these missions, soldiers had to stay awake for actually 5 days and five nights, up to a week. And they thought they would... test new drugs or try to, they actually try to find a new wonder drug that was stronger than methamphetamine. They never found it.
But they tested this chewing gum on people in the concentration camps.
Well, in the concentration camp of Sachsenhausen, there was a penalty unit of inmates that had to test shoe soles for the German shoe industry. So these inmates had to walk in circles for days and test these shoe soles. So the Navy thought, we're going to hire this unit from the SS, pay the SS money so we can use these inmates, and they will have to test different drug combinations so we can find out which drugs are the best.
What happened when the pharmaceutical factories were bombed?
Well, when the British decided to bomb, especially the Merck company in Darmstadt, who was making Hitler's favorite opioid, Oikodal, Hitler actually, or Morell rather, ran into a problem because he ran out of supplies. And he was sending, there's notes of his where he describes how he's sending his aides on motorcycles through bombed out Berlin, going from pharmacy to pharmacy, trying to find the opioids that Hitler was used to and not being able to do so, which resulted in withdrawal symptoms that Hitler suffered from, the famous tremor, the shaking of his limbs. And in the end,
they thought it was Parkinson's.
Well, it's also possible that he had Parkinson's because Morell gave him a medicine against Parkinson's once. It could be true, but I think it's more plausible that he was actually suffering from cold turkey.
Write that Hitler had an unwavering sense of optimism about the war, even when defeat seemed inevitable. That was because he was taking the drugs?
Well, Morell writes on numerous occasions that Hitler asks for the strong injection which contained the opioid before important meetings with generals in order to be able to project confidence towards his generals that the war would obviously be won by the Germans.
Now, in some reviews, it's been said that your account of drug use in the Third Reich is exaggerated, even somewhat of an excuse for Nazi behavior. What's your response to that?
I don't agree at all that it's an excuse for Nazi behavior. I actually speak about the question of guilt and responsibility in Blitzed, and I come to the conclusion that it doesn't diminish it at all. So I don't see this argument. In the argument of overstating, historians, there's this historian who claims that, and I mean historians have overlooked this fact for a long time. So I can understand that some historians.
And why do you think they have overlooked it, since you found it in the archives? Is it just an uncomfortable part of this?
Yeah,
history?
I think they were actually afraid that if they would talk about drugs, they would excuse something. So I think it has to do with political correctness. But I think, first of all, it doesn't excuse anything. And second of all, it's a historical fact, and it has to be talked about. And so me being a non-historian, I had no inhibitions to look at it from this angle. And other historians, actually, like Anthony Beaver or Ian Kershaw, praised the book. So there's like a dispute within the class of historians.
You've written scripts for Wim Wenders. You've written novel, and this is an act of journalism. You just go between one and the other?
I would say I'm a born and bred novelist, and this is really where my passion is. But I realized that with this topic, there's nothing to invent. It's much better as a nonfiction book. So I decided to choose that genre.
Norman Ohler will be speaking with Rolling Stone editor Jason Diamond tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Community Bookstore at 143 7th Avenue in Brooklyn. And then on Thursday the 23rd, he will be appearing at the Roosevelt House at 6 p.m. That's at 4749 East 65th Street. The book Blitzed. Thank you so much.
It's great to be here. Thank you.